The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240. On WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Phil Donahue here with you, taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the first day of October. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. Got a nice show lined up for you tonight, sort of a 1969-themed show. Up first, we'll welcome in the former outfielder for the 1969 World Champion Mets, Rod Gasper. In the second half, we'll speak to the author of the new book entitled The Wonder Year. The championships of the New York Jets, Mets, and Knicks were only part of the story in 1969. The author's name is Bert Flieger. He'll join us in the second half of the show. Sit back, relax. Enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We have got some great stuff lined up for you in the next few hours here. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, we're waiting for Rod Gasper to join us tonight on the program. He was, of course, a member of the 1969 World Champion New York Mets. Really involved in one of the pivotal plays of that 1969 World Series, and we'll be sure to talk with him about that. His dash home on J.C. Martin's bunt. We'll get his take on the whole situation. Rod's coming right up, folks. Don't worry. We got everything under control here. And then, of course, Bert Flieger will discuss his great book, The Wonder Year, and that'll be coming up right after Rod. Well, my first guest, as I said, a member of the 1969 World Champion New York Mets. He was involved in, as I said, one of the pivotal plays of the 69 series against the vaunted Baltimore Orioles. And we'll be sure to discuss that with him tonight. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Rod Gasper. Rod, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
No worries. It's great to have you back with us. You were on the show about 4 or 5 years ago when I first started out. And we had a nice conversation back then, and I'm sure we'll do the same tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure we will, Bill. Like I told you before, I'm at a 60th wedding anniversary party.
Yeah.
So if I have to cut you a little short down the road, I'm sorry, but
okay.
Show you how old I am. I'm going to a client's 60th wedding anniversary.
That's unheard of. Unheard of in these parts.
Yeah, right. Anyway, good to talk. Good to speak with you. Go ahead.
Outstanding. Well, you were born and raised in Southern California. What teams did you follow back then, Rod? Who are some of your favorite players, et cetera?
Of course, Mickey Mantle is my favorite, like most young people growing up, guys that I knew. And then, we didn't get radio or television back then to watch the Mick or the Yankees. So
right.
My dad would follow the Dodgers when Colfax and Drysdale were there. He'd have the radio on, so we got to listen to a lot of their games. I can remember my dad was an iron worker, Lloyd Gasper, just the best man I ever knew in my life. And thankfully is my dad, but he would come home from iron work, just tired and come home about 5:30, and he'd go out in the backyard and he'd turn on the radio and have a glass of, I remember he liked Jim Beam. He'd take Jim Beam and ice and water and then just sit back and relax, have just two of those. He never drank more than two, or maybe even just one. And he'd listen to the Dodgers on radio. We'd be back there, with him, listening to the games. And at that time, I liked a lot of the players on the Dodgers, especially Colfax and Drysdale. But Yeah, they were our only team at that time. You know, that's in the, what, the late 50s.
Right.
58, 59, early 60s. So I was just, you know, 12 years. I was 12 years old in 1958. So I was a little guy, but, you know, we used to enjoy listening to them on the radio.
Sure. Now, you attended Long Beach State University. The Mets decided to draft you in 66. You decided to hang on for another year. You had 342 in your junior year. What made you stick around at Long Beach State, Rod?
You must be reading the back of my one and only baseball card. Huh? out of high school, out of Lakeland High School, I wasn't anything special as a ball player. I was average, but I was still small. And I was still growing when I was a senior in high school. I probably weighed 135 pounds, 5'9".
Wow.
And before I went to Long Beach State University, I played ball at Long Beach City College, junior college there. And I made the team, but the guy, the coach at the time, wasn't starting me, you know. And I was just starting to develop, just starting to get bigger and stronger. And finally, when he got smart and started playing me, I ended up leading the team in hitting. And I was one of the top hitters in the league, and then I got the MVP award or top hitter award or some kind of award there at Long Beach City College. And then from there, Long Beach State, the coach Bob Westhoff had contacted me, and some others had too, but I wanted, you know, I liked Mr. Westhoff, and I won, you know, so I signed to play with them and got a scholarship to play with Long Beach State College in 1966. And I was still developing, you know, and improving each year. As a ball player. When I was 16, 17, I wasn't anything special. But when I became 18, 19, the development took over, got stronger, and, you know, I became a decent ball player. And as I went to Long Beach State, got better and better. And they did draft me in 66. And I hit well there, as you said. But I didn't sign because, you know, I said, well, you know, if you draft me, if you give me $20,000, I'll sign.
Yeah.
They drafted me like in the 15th round, Bill. So, you know, they weren't going to give me that. So I said, well, you know, I'll just go back to school.
Right.
So I turned down the $12,000 they offered me and went back to Long Beach State College the next year, 1967, had another good year, and the Mets drafted me again, which I don't know if they do, you know, teams do that much anymore. And so this time is the second round of the secondary phase. Rich Folkers, I think, was number one pick. I was number two, and Gary Gentry was number three. Of course,
okay.
Remember Gentry, of course.
Sure.
So
I even remember Rich Folkers, right? That's how.
Yeah. Left-handed pitcher, yeah.
Yeah.
So they knew I wanted to sign. I was ready to sign. I was a junior then in college, and so as a number two pick, I figured, well, heck, I'll get my $20,000 now. Well, guess what? They come in the house, Nelson Berberick and Dee Fondy. And Dee Fondy played a lot of years in the big leagues.
He did.
In Chicago, and he was the first baseman. And Nelson ended up in the front office with the Mets because he signed all the so-called phenoms in, Gentry and me and some others. But they came in the house, and guess how much money they offered me again?
$12,000. Yeah.
So I go, you got to be kidding me. And so I told them I won 20, and they said, no, we're going to give you 12 in school and all that. And my parents, the year before, when I turned down the $12,000, they got so irritated with me for turning down that kind of money because they'd never seen that kind of money before, you know.
Yeah, right.
So I ended up signing for the 12 because they knew I was ready to go, and that was it. And they sent me to Double-A ball, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
And that was a tough league, wasn't it, back then?
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
What made it tough, besides the great pitching, was the ballparks were terrible. I mean, you know, they were older ballparks, and the gliding was just awful. And, in fact, I think that, you know, the game they had recently in Williamsport during the Little League World Series with Pittsburgh and somebody else?
Yeah.
Remember that game?
Uh-huh.
They said it was at Bowman Field. Was that the same field I played on with Williamsport? I think it might be.
Oh, man.
You know, that was 50 years ago.
Yeah. They had to have redone it since then.
Well, they did, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
I think it's the same area as, you know, where I played, the same field, I think. I could be wrong. So, anyway, I played, you know, that's where I went to in the Eastern League. And so, after the, you know, they told me right away that I'd be playing right away when I went to Williamsport. Well, that was the first lie I heard in baseball. You know, I sat on the bench for a week, and I was going crazy. And I'm watching the center fielder they had there, and I'm thinking, you know, and he's playing there, and he's been playing a couple of years, and they said he's a real good defensive center fielder, and I'm not going to give his name, but I can see why he didn't make any errors, because the guy never went for anything. You know, he never went for any balls at all.
Yeah.
And so finally, Roy Sievers, remember him?
Yeah, sure.
He's been Washington Senators, led the league in home runs, I think, at least one year.
Yeah.
He was a manager, and he finally played me. And, you know, I played, and I started having a good year, and I ended up, I think, in the top 10 in hitting in the Eastern League, Bill, and I hit 260. I think that's not very good. Well, I don't think it's that good either, but the league was so tough pitching-wise and ballpark-wise with bad light that there was only one 300 hitter in the whole league, and he was on our team. His name is Bernie Smith. He's a little guy, played third base stocky, but he could hit.
The legendary Bernie Smith.
You remember that name?
No. No, I don't remember Bernie, no.
Nobody did, because nobody gave him a chance
to
the big leagues. And Bernie could play. I mean, he's the only guy in the league that hit 300, but I was in the top 10 in hitting. I hit 260 and supposedly, you know, had a decent year. So then the next year, of course, they moved to Texas, Double-A Texas League, and that kicked me off because they sent me back to Double-A because I thought I should go to Triple-A with Gentry, but, you know, Gary, you know, he went to Double-A with me when he signed at Williamsport. Next year he was in Jacksonville, so
yeah,
that's where I was hoping to be. But the next year in Texas League, I hit, I think, 310. I think the card says I hit 309 or 308, but I think I hit 310. And I led the league in hits in the Texas League, but, Bill, I actually thought maybe because my first year in Pro Bowl, I actually thought I had a better year the first year in Williamsport than I did the second year in Texas League, even though I made the All-Star team there and, you know, led the league in hits. That just shows you the difference in the leagues.
Yeah.
Seeing the Texas League and the, you know, the Eastern League at the time.
Yeah, quite a disparity, Rod, definitely. We got Rod Gasper tonight with us on Sports Talk 1240. You look like you were destined for Triple-A Tidewater, but you stuck with the big club. I believe it was Shamsky hurt his back, so Hodges put you on the team.
Exactly. After the 16th season, because I played over a year, I guess the rules at that time, if they wanted to protect me from the draft, I guess whatever the Major League draft was, you know, from signed players, minor league players, they had to put me on the 40-man roster, mm-hmm. which they did. So I was on the 40-man roster, so nobody could draft me to another Major League club. And so they invited me to spring training with no intention, I found out later on, of keeping me. See, when I invited to spring training in 1969, I figured I was going to make the team. I mean,
yeah.
That's the kind of confidence I had. I didn't know who Art was. I didn't know who Cleon or Tommy or Sabota or any of those guys. And I didn't care who they were, so I figured I was just
right.
as good or better than them. And that's, you know, I was probably too cocky for my own good at the time and overly confident. But you really have to know you're good and be confident in your abilities in order to succeed, not just in baseball, but anything in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that kind of confidence. And when they didn't even look at me, I mean, Gil didn't know who I was. Yogi didn't know how he was. Stignatano, Rube Walker, they didn't know who Gasper was.
Yeah.
So, like you said, that I was destined for Tidewater, their Triple-A club. But when Art hurt his back, gave me a chance to go on a road trip with the Mets, and Gil started me, and I went on like a 14-game hitting streak. And because of playing well in spring training, I made the club.
You started that first game against Montreal, Rod, at Shea Stadium, the first ever win in the first ever game by the Expos. But that, as you mentioned, Gil, he really knew how to get the most out of his ball players, didn't he?
He's the best. I mean,
yeah.
Gil should not only be in the Hall of Fame as a player, but as a manager also. He ran that team like a business. We all knew the employees at the time, which of course not the way it is now, but the employees at the time the 69 Met ball players knew who the boss was, and we knew what our job was. And I'll tell you, we clicked. I mean, I know we only had a 246 team batting average, something like that, but we knew how to play the game, which I can't say much to the guys nowadays. But, you know, and, you know, we played well. We played good defense. Our pitching was well, and we hit in the clutch.
Right.
And, you know, I give all the credit. I mean, we had talent, obviously. I mean, you got a Seaver, Kuzman, and Nolan Ryan, you know, and a bunch of others, McAndrew and Gentry as pitchers. And you got the outfield we had, and Clendenin and Grody as a catcher. That's a pretty good ball club. Harrelson is shortstop. But, you know, but it was all Gill. I mean, he always seemed to push the right buttons, and sadly he left us too soon, because I think the Mets would have won a number of pennants over the years if he had continued managing instead of passing away at age, 48, I think.
48, yeah, right, Rod. I agree he should be in Cooperstown. That, I've worn out my soapbox standing on it here trying to get Gill into Cooperstown. But do you remember your first homer against Mike McCormick?
Oh, yeah, I remember it because I didn't think I'd be playing that game. The night before, I was out all night, okay, thinking I'm not playing the next day. I come to the ballpark with no sleep, and I saw my name in the lineup, and I was kind of ticked, you know.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, tired, but, you know, you think about it. How can a 23-year-old kid be tired? So, but sometimes I have my best games when I was traveling on road trips or whatever and didn't sleep much. And that night, I was fired up. I remember hitting the ball hard a couple times before my third at bat against Mike, and, you know, I hit that home run. There was over 50,000 people there, and we ended up, you know, winning the game in that inning. I think it was the seventh inning or eighth inning. I think it's the seventh. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I remember the home run and hitting right-handed into the left field bullpen, and we ended up scoring a couple runs to win the game.
There was another game in particular that I recall doing my homework, Rod, where you guys had the McCovey shift. People realize that there was a shift for a guy by the name of Willie McCovey, who's in the Hall of Fame, a tremendous left-hand power hitter who teamed with Mays for many, many offensive exploits in San Francisco. But the only time the teams really shifted were for guys like Frank Howard, guys like Willie McCovey. But there was a time where you were involved in a play with McCovey hitting the ball, and you threw a strike to Grody to get the runner out.
Yeah, you know, and people bring that up, and, you know, over the years, back then they didn't film a lot of things, and I was hoping I could find a film of that play.
Yeah.
Because that was the best play I ever made in my life, and of course, came at a clutch time in the game. But, you know, back then, I've even checked with MLB and different organizations, see if they have films. Old time films of the the Mets when we played in '69, and there are some stuff, but not a whole lot.
No, right.
I mean the World Series, of course, but yeah, I remember that because McCovey wasn't the only guy that did the shift on. He also did with Richie Allen or Dick Allen.
Oh yeah.
Remember putting Al Weiss in, you know, because when Dick was hitting, he, you know, full hitter. So in that particular game, yeah, I think Sobota was in right field, so he was playing down the right field line. H, he moved over to right center field, and I was in almost center field. It's like left center field. I mean, it was a long way from that third base foul line. When Tug was pitching, you know, I don't know, he threw McCovey a screwball, and McCovey hit a 9-iron down the left field line, and at the time we were playing at Candlestick Park, and that ball is... I don't know if you remember Candlestick Park that much, but it was wet, foggy, and just miserable conditions playing there.
Yeah, it wasn't a nice place. Yeah.
Oh, man. That ball hit the grass and just stuck.
Ooh, you know.
And so I knew, and there's a guy named Bob Burda on first base. And this is the bottom of the ninth, I think, and the score is tied 1-1. I believe it was.
Yeah.
And the ball hit, and I knew that, you know, I had to get to just fire to home plate. And so as soon as the ball was hit, I knew I couldn't catch it. I just took off for it. The ball hit, stuck. I picked up my bare hand, the left hand, my throwing hand, pivoted my left foot, you know, took a hop and threw a strike to Grody at home. I mean, it was the best throw I ever made in my life. And it was right in front of the warning track. So I think I probably threw it 310, maybe 320 feet on the line to Grody. All right, Grody catches the ball. Bird is coming in. We got him by 15 feet. You know, so Grody takes him out. And I think it shocked Jerry so much that he forgot how many outs there were. And you know what a heads-up ball player Jerry was.
Sure, that's shocking.
Yeah, I mean, he was just very sharp, you know, end of the game. He flipped the ball to the mound thinking that was a third out instead of the second out. Clendenin saw this, comes over, you know, picks it up, and throws to Bobby Fowle at third to get McCovey for a double play. Next inning, Clendenin comes up, hits a home run, and we win.
Yeah.
I think he hit off Gaylord Perry.
Off Gaylord Perry, exactly. Yeah.
The other thing about that throw is that I found a clip of that, not from the Met organization, but from the San Francisco Giant organization, and they had a highlight thing, you know, of the previous 69 year with the Giants.
Yeah.
And that play of mine was in it, and I have it. So this guy, I don't know who the guy is or was, but he got it for me, and he sent it to me, you know, a CD.
Yeah.
I have it at home, and it shows the play.
Oh,
and
outstanding.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what a great piece of film. I know. What a great play that was, Rod. Now, we'll move ahead to the series now. One thing you're famous for is the tremendous line by Hall of Famer Frank Robinson, who I believe he said, "Bring on the Mets and bring on Ron Gasper." And then I think it was Paul Blair said, it's Rod, stupid.
Right.
And so he comes back with, all right, well, let's bring on Ron Stupid then.
Right.
But
he said Ron Casper.
Oh.
Who in the hell is Ron Casper? And that's when the other guy chimed in. But, yeah, that was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah. But, well, he soon found out who everybody was. Let's talk about the play with J.C. Martin. Give us a rundown on that.
Well, of course, I'm on second base.
Right.
Can't tell you, this is a Seaver game, Tom's game. It is the game that Sabota made the greatest outfield play I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
Ronnie made that play. But Seaver, that was his game, and J.C. Pinch hit for Tom. I was on second with no outs. And back then, you know, we knew how to sacrifice bunt, okay? Unlike today's game.
Of course, yeah.
He laid down a perfect bunt on the first base line, and I think the pitcher was Pete Rickert.
Pete Rickert, yeah.
Left-handed pitcher, and he threw the ball, and it hit J.C. And, of course, I'm running the third base, not looking over my shoulder at that time, but like everybody else, I see the ball in the film clip hit J.C. on the left wrist. The ball starts rolling up towards second. And Eddie Yost, I'm rounding third, Bill. Eddie Yost is a foot from me, 2 feet from me, yelling at me to run. Well, I can't hear him because there's 55-plus thousand people there yelling and screaming. And they're probably thinking, that dumb gasser, get home, you know. Why isn't he running? Well, I happened to turn my shoulder and notice that the ball was rolling towards second base, and that's when I took off and scored the run for our team and for Tom. In fact, Seaver was the first guy to greet me.
Well, that was his only World Series win.
You know, that's a trivia question, isn't it? You know, how many World Series wins did Seaver have, and, you know, what was the story behind the one World Series win? Yeah, that was his only World Series win. Too bad.
Amazing. Definitely.
He was awesome. He was the best, Tom was.
We almost reached the end, Rod, so we made it. Give us a little rundown on what's it like to be young, successful, and a world champion living in New York City.
Well, you hit that right in the head. I mean, I was 23 years old. I kind of joked with people. I said, you know, I peaked at age 23. I've been going downhill ever since.
I hear you. Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of kidding. Well, I am kidding because God has blessed us, and I'll tell you, we're doing real well. My beautiful bride, Sheridan, and I are sitting here at these people's home here, and you know, there's a lot of people sitting over there, but we're back in the corner so we can hear you and all. We're getting ready to join them. But I appreciate you checking in, Bill. And, hey, by the way, I got to tell you something.
Sure.
You know, for a guy that didn't have that big of a big league career, I got a lot of publicity, if you remember. Okay?
Sure, yeah.
For saying we'd win in four straight in the World Series and all that, and when I told Lindsey Nelson, and then we did win in four after the series was over, but we lost the first game, won the next four, so I didn't say which four we'd win in. But, you know, I did, you know, with the Robinson thing and all that. But the thing is that, you know, I played the game 10 years, and I was in the big leagues for a while, and I'm very happy about that. But I, you know, for some reason, some guy, and I've had these guys do this before, I had a guy call me a number of months ago, and he wanted to write a book on me.
Wow.
He'd go, yeah. Now, wait a second. Now, why do you want to write a book on me? I mean, I'm just a member of that team. We had a bunch of no-names on that team. So, of course,
yeah.
People remember Tom Seaver and probably Jerry Kuzman and, you know, maybe, you know, some of the other guys, maybe Clinton and me, but we had a bunch of no-names. He said, well, that's the kind of guy I want to write about. So this guy's writing a book on me right now, Bill.
Not bad.
And, yeah, it's called, I think it's Blue River Press or something.
Yeah.
And his name's David Russell. Nice kid. Haven't met him personally, but... So anyways, I just want to let you know that there might be a book coming out in the spring of 2019, the 50th anniversary.
Oh, I will watch out for that, Rod. I'll keep an eye out, definitely.
Okay, well, thank you.
You have a good night, Rod. Happy anniversary to the happy couple, and thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
My pleasure, Bill.
Take care, Rod. We'll be in touch.
All right, my man. Take care.
Rod Gasper, folks. Up next, we'll talk to the author of The Wonder Year, Bert Fleeger. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, Bill Donahue with you, our number two. On Sports Talk 1240, I hope you're having a good evening, a great day in sports today. The New York Mets finally stopped the horror and put us out of our misery with a big loss in Philadelphia. The Jets have two wins, the same as the New England Patriots, and two more than the New York Giants, who took it on the chin from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers down on Dale Mabry in Tampa. So we've had quite a memorable day in sports. I'd like to introduce my next guest. Bert was born in Hempstead, New York, raised in Uniondale. those magical years of the late 60s, and Burt's enthusiasm for the local New York sports teams formed the basis of the new book we'll be discussing called The Wonder Year. He's a survivor of Catholic grade school, as am I, so I can relate to that perfectly. Burt, he's blessed with many friendships that go back to those days, and he loves reminiscing with friends, old and new, about those sports teams, events, and characters of his childhood. He's lived many places, but he will never forget his Long Island roots, and he still carries New York in his heart. I'd like to introduce to the audience tonight on Sports Talk 1240, Burt Flieger. Burt, good evening.
Hello, Bill. Nice to be with you tonight. Thanks
great,
for having me.
Great to have you with us, Burt. We'd like to get right into it. The book called The Wonder Year. We just got off the phone with Rod Gasper, so we set a little tone towards 1969 on the program tonight. You had a meeting with a great author who I remember from the Civil War, from Ken Burns Baseball, Doris Kearns Goodwin. Talk a little bit about that, Burt.
Well, Bill, Doris Kearns Goodwin, you're right, she's a great writer, and she wrote a book called Wait Till Next Year about the Brooklyn Dodgers and her passion as a Dodger fan, also growing up on Long Island like myself. And my mother, who had a tremendous passion for baseball, as did her mother, read this book probably a half a dozen times, and she kept giving it to me and calling me up and reading passages from the book on the phone to me. And so I had the chance to meet Doris Kearns Goodwin after one of her lectures about Wait Till Next Year. And I explained to her at that time about an idea that had been in my mind for some time about 1969 and the amazing three consecutive underdog to champion situations with the Jets, the Mets, and the Knicks. And just a few words from her, she motivated me and inspired me and said, you can do it, Burt. You know, I know you're, you know, I'm not a professional writer at that time, and I was really inspired by her. And she also wrote a very nice piece to my mother and said she's still the number one Dodgers fan. So that's how this book got started.
Outstanding. Great story, Burt. Well, you talk so much about growing up and about the kids in the neighborhood. A lot of folks, a lot of characters. Lay the groundwork with that for us.
Sure. So I was fortunate enough to grow up on a dead-end street, 16 houses on a dead-end street in Uniondale, Mize Court. And we'd like to think that Mize Court was pretty special, but I know there were hundreds like it all around Long Island and many other places around the country. But our street had 45 kids on it at that time, and most of them were about my age, give or take a few years, and everybody just loved the sports. So not only did we watch the sports every chance we could, but we also played it every day on our nice, long, narrow, dead-end street. And every imaginable sport that we all played growing up. So that was a lot of activity and a lot of fun.
Definitely. And so unique, and as you mentioned, to have that many kids and the sports activities going on and all the families together, great basis for the book. Now, chapter one, you start with the New York Jets. Kill the guy with the ball.
Yeah, so
go ahead.
what I wanted to do with this book was not just write it as a sports book or a history book, but I wanted to write it as really from the perspective of kids. I was 10 years old in 1969,
right?
And so many kids, plus or minus a few years, who were growing up in that era, we had the chance to play together. So I wanted to write it from a different perspective than from an adult's point of view. And one of the things that we set the tone for the football season was this, you know, what we called kill the guy with the ball. And it was basically, you know, everybody against one guy who had the football. And so we played this on our front lawns. We played it in the backyards. It was just a lot of fun. And people just, you know, again, we were 10-year-olds, so we weren't that big and strong or fast to do any real damage. But it was plenty of fun just tackling guys and causing fumbles and grabbing it again and rolling out again.
Sure. over and over again, definitely. Now, what kids listening tonight, Bert, may not understand is that the New York Jets, first of all, were in a Super Bowl. Second of all, they were the underdogs in the Super Bowl. And they had their star quarterback, Joe Namath, guaranteeing that the team would win.
Right. So, again, this was this season was the 68-69 season was really, well, it was the third Super Bowl. And until that time, the Jets were in the American Football League, and the Power League, the original league, was the National Football League. So what I didn't really understand as the season progressed was how much of an inferior league the AFL was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our friends, because Joe Namath was our local star. He was the one, really the first big name that came into the AFL 3 years earlier. And so we consider them to be equals, but that was really not the case.
Right. Definitely. And again, what younger folks may not realize is there was only one broadcaster, not a team to go to at halftime, a pregame bunch of guys announcing, a postgame, and there was no halftime show. Imagine watching a Super Bowl with no halftime show. That's one of the biggest draws today is who's playing at halftime.
Right. Well, I won't say that that's my biggest attraction to the Super Bowl, but I know it is for a lot of people.
Sure.
But yeah, it was so much simpler back then. You know, there was one announcer, not a series of sideline announcers and color men and ex-players. In fact, for Super Bowl III, the one that the Jets were in, Kurt Gowdy, the famous Kurt Gowdy, he was the only announcer all the way through. And was a legendary announcer, did a fantastic job. But just, yeah, the contrast to the situation today.
And Chapter 2, Bert, you go into the story of the New York Mets, a topic that really hit home this evening for everybody. And the opening paragraph, you make the statement, "My baseball glove was my constant companion that spring." Sort of brings like a Stand By Me type ring to the book. And then you go into the Yankees, the decline of that ball club, the retiring of Mantle just before the 69 season really laid them to rest in that Horace Clark era.
That's right. Yeah, you know, full disclosure is that my first team was the New York Yankees, largely because of Mickey Mantle, but by the end of the 1968 season, Mantle was pretty much done. He was on bad knees. He was not the player he once was, and the Yankees, the rest of the Yankees, were the same. So maybe the younger listeners don't know the full story, but the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants had moved to California 5 years earlier, and it wasn't, or 1957, and it wasn't until 1962 that the Mets were formed. So if you weren't a Yankee fan, they were like today, you love them or you hate them, you didn't have any other New York baseball teams for that five-year period. And when the Mets came on board in 1962, of course, they were an expansion team. They were horrible in the beginning, but slowly but surely, they got to be a little bit better. And by 1968, were a respectable team.
Right. Definitely. We got Bert Flieger with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240 talking about his new book entitled The Wonder Year. People didn't realize at the time how young these ball players were on the New York Mets. They were really a bunch of upstart, hungry young players, but they really turned it on towards the middle end of the season, had great battles with the Chicago Cubs, took a really established Atlanta Braves ball club to the National League Championship and defeated them, a team with Hall of Famers on that ball club. And then the famous World Series against the Baltimore Orioles. And as we spoke with Rod Gasper, Frank Robinson stating, "Bring on Ron Gasper and the Mets." He didn't even know who these guys were, but he learned pretty quick, didn't he, Bert?
For sure. And what an exciting season it was. And, you know, no one really had that high expectations for the Mets. And, even though they had a good start to the season, by middle of August, they were still 9.5 games out of first place. And they began to turn it on, and everybody got more and more excited. But you're right, Bill, the team was so young. Tom Seaver was 24. Gary Gentry was 22. Nolan Ryan was 22. Tug McGraw was 24. Jerry Kuzman was just 26. There was an amazing pitching staff that they had. Mm-hmm. And on the player side of it, the same thing. I mean, you know, Cleon Jones was their star. He was just 26. Tommy Agee was 26. Bud Harrelson was 25 at the time. So this was a very young team, a very new ball club. And when they started to turn it on toward the end of the season and clinched the division, which that was 1969, was the first year that there was a divisional playoff. And again, just imagine that. Before that, you had to win, be in first place in the National League and in first place in the American League to go to the World Series. But this was the first year of the divisional.
You're exactly right. Now, how was the atmosphere on Mize during that particular summer of 1969? A lot of passion, a lot of interest in the Mets?
Absolutely. I mean, every single person, from young to old, guys and girls, everyone was watching every single game and coming and talking about it in the street. Of course, we had a share of stick ball that we played on the block and slap ball or box ball, as some people called it. So we were constantly playing baseball of one form or another on the street all day long. And everybody had their favorite players. Mine was Bud Harrelson. You know, everybody had their favorite player that they imitated out in the street.
Right.
And so you can just imagine. You can just imagine as we were able to get past the Atlanta Braves in the divisional playoffs. And then go to the World Series, and that was another one where it was okay. We're a great team, but we were playing the Baltimore Orioles, another Baltimore team who was 109-53 that year with all the stars that they have. And despite even the Mets being such a great pitching staff, the Orioles had a better pitching staff statistically, at least.
Right, and no one really gave the Mets a chance, but they defeated the Baltimore Orioles 4-1, and they won those 4 games in succession after dropping that first game 1 in Baltimore when Don Buford leads off with the home run, runs by Bud Harrelson and says, "You guys ain't seen nothing yet," you know, and these guys came back to eat those words, and it certainly was a sweet feeling for all the Met fans, as it must have been in your neighborhood. And we move ahead to the next chapter, and it's the New York Knickerbockers, which certainly had a great ring in my neighborhood as well, with everybody being a particular player while you're playing 3-on-3 or 5-on-5 out in the street. Now, you mentioned, Bert, that it was 510 dribbles from your front door to the basketball court. That's tremendous.
Yeah, well, you know, we were passionate sports fans, and we just moved on after baseball was over. We just moved on to the next season, and I used to, you know, every day run home from school, change clothes, and grab my basketball and head out my front door. And you know, depending upon, you know, they had these imaginary defenders in the street, and depending upon I was doing fast breaks or trying to get around the defense, you know, it might have been a little bit more than 5'10 or a little bit less, but we played at these basketball courts with a great group of guys just about every day, whether it was raining or snowing or whatever it is. We'd get shovels and move the snow out of the way, and again, like you said, we'd have our favorite players and we'd imitate them, and we'd sometimes get some people to imitate the competition, and we'd get in there and block their shots to make us feel better about it.
Yeah, sure. I can relate to moving the rain and the snow and the ice in particular, Bert, to get to the courts. Now, you mentioned that the Knicks were a really fun team to follow. Give us an example of why that's so.
Well, you know, they were a really unique team at the time. We hear today about, you know, team basketball. The Knicks were the first team that really were, even though there were stars on the team, but they played team basketball. They were really good passers. They were unselfish. They had, you know, they were ninth in the league in points that year, but they were fourth in assists. So almost every basket involved a great play between the players. And they also played great team defense. So they had their, you know, their starting fives, Willis Reed, Frazier, Bradley DeBuscher, Dick Barnett, and then they had the guys coming off the bench, Mike Reardon, Dave Stallworth, Cassie Russell, a great group of guys, and, of course, a great coach in Red Holtzman, the crusty old Red Holtzman,
right.
Who led them to the championship that year.
What a tremendous bench, too, Bert. I recall that on with that Knick ball club. During the expansion draft, they lost a couple of guys to the Buffalo Braves, and I forget what the – I think the other team was the Cleveland Cavaliers. And some of these guys went on to start for the expansion team. So it gives you an idea of what kind of strength the Knicks had down the line on that bench.
Right, right. And the other interesting thing, Bill, about the Knicks season contrast to the Mets, where we're able to watch a lot of the Met games, very few Knicks games were on TV.
Yeah.
So that pointed us to the radio and Marv Albert. And, I mean, he was amazing to, you know, we say we wanted to watch Marv on the radio.
Right.
Because there was no TV, but he was so descriptive and so innovative. And we used to laugh. We remember listening to some games and somebody would, you could hear it fine, but you'd walk in front of the radio and somebody would say, get out of the way, I can't see the radio. So, because we didn't want to miss anything that Marv said.
No, Marv was the gospel on the radio for the New York Knickerbockers. I remember, Bert, that they'd maybe have a game on once a week or so, if that. And it would be an away game because they never televised from Madison Square Garden. And the great Bob Wolf, who just passed away recently, used to do the play-by-play for the Knickerbockers. In fact, you mentioned the 18-game winning streak that set the record for the Knicks. I do remember watching that game on TV when Bob Cousy put himself in for the Cincinnati Royals.
That's right. What a game that was. And that was at a neutral site. I think it was actually in Cleveland, even though it was Cincinnati against New York. It was an unusual game, and you're right. It was on the radio, of course, and televised.
Yeah. And as we mentioned, Marv Albert. Such great broadcasters, too, during that period, Bert. You had Lindsey Nelson, Ralph Kiner, Bob Murphy for the Mets. You had Bob Wolf on the TV, a baseball Hall of Famer, as well as Marv Albert, a legendary broadcaster. So we really had it made listening to the radio or watching on TV.
Absolutely. It was a fantastic year.
And that was also that year, folks may not know, a guy by the name of Lou Alcindor's rookie year, who went on to change his name to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And we had the Laker ball club laden with Hall of Famers. Jerry West, Will Chamberlain, the great Elgin Baylor. Again, the Knicks were underdogs, but they came back in all the series that year to win.
That's right, and Baltimore took them seven games in the first series there, and that was a nail-biter to the end. Then they played the Bucks, Lou Alcindor's Bucks, and were able to get them, beat them in five games. And if you can remember, Bill, at the end of the last game when the Madison Square Garden fans were starting this chant, "Goodbye, Louis, we hate to see you go." The fans, of course, at Madison Square Garden, none better in the world, none more knowledgeable in the world. So we were able to beat them. And then, of course, we had to play the Lakers. And that was another one. That was another series that, again, the games were not televised. And, of course, being on the West Coast, the games were late. But so we were listening to the radio as best we could. And, of course, who could forget Willis Reed's injury? In game five, he was out game six, and no one expected him to play in game seven. And there he is walking onto the court. And what a, you know, still any Knick fan can remember that moment in time.
As you say, Bert, and as we recall imitating our favorite players, I remember taping my legs up like Willis did. I didn't have anything wrong with my legs. I just taped them the same way to be like Willis.
Right. Yeah, we all hobbled and threw our left-handed hook shots up there.
Oh, yeah.
The next day, and Of course, the beginning of Game 7 was a classic. Willis, of course, came out at the last minute, made the first two shots of the game for the Knicks. Didn't play much at all. Walt Frazier had a great game. Arguably could have been the MVP of the series, even though Willis was awarded it. Frazier had 36 points, 19 rebounds, and 7 assists. Sorry, 19 assists and 7 rebounds that game. So a fantastic game and a great series, great year for the New York Knickerbockers.
Right. Again, the younger folks may not realize the career that Walt Clyde Frazier had. They maybe just remember him as the broadcaster these days, swishing and dishing for the New York Knicks. But there was a Walt Clyde Frazier on the basketball court, and he did show up mightily in that Game 7, didn't he?
He sure did, and what a great moment that was.
Definitely. Now, we talked about the Mets, we talked about the Knicks, we talked about the New York Jets, but there was, the title of the book mentions, Bert, there was a lot more happening in the country than just the New York sports teams. It was really a time of transition, a time of change, a time of social upheaval. Let's get into some of that you mentioned in the book.
Yeah, you're right, Bill. It was, again, trying to look at it from the perspective of a kid, of a 10-year-old. The things that were going on in the world at that time, of course, right before that in 1968, you had the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
There was the 1968 Olympics, which there was a lot of controversy around some of the activities of the American team there. There was the Vietnam War that was going on, and everybody was impacted in one way, from a family member or a friend, in one way. So many people were impacted by that. And then there were a lot of other, amazing things. The first lunar landing, July 20th,
right.
1969. What a great moment for our country, really, and the world. And then Woodstock, just a month after that. What an interesting period of time. I can remember... there were a lot of conservative parents and doubters, but I think many people, once they started to hear the music and it was about peace and love, they started to understand and accept that the world was changing, that we were in a transition. And so not only the event, but gosh, what great music we had. I know my kids say to me, you guys had the best music in the late 60s and the 70s. So that was true. That was there were exciting times and a lot of other things going on. And really, it was my pleasure to recount them and bring back memories for a lot of people.
We're fortunate tonight to have Bert Flieger with us on Sports Talk 1240. You also mentioned, Bert, and I mentioned in the opening, that you're a Catholic school survivor. Let's reminisce a little bit about that, because I have my own experiences to tell as well.
Well, anybody that went to Catholic school for a number of years, and I went to St. Martha's in Uniondale for 8 years from first grade to eighth grade, everybody's got their stories, whether it's mostly probably related around the nuns that we had as teachers and the rules that were a little different back then than they are now. But really, to be honest, so many fond memories to go along with the funny stories. And I think all of us got a really good education going through them. So I'd love to hear some of your stories, Bill.
Well, I tell you, they do center around the nuns. Then after that, Bert, I went on to St. Joseph's in Babylon, who had the Franciscan Brothers, which was a whole nother level of religious persecution, if you will. A lot of physicality. I don't think that they'd be able to get away with it these days, but we were nonetheless happy for it, because it really set us off on the right foot as far as going to high school, which I spent 4 more years in Catholic high school, but it was a little less obtrusive than first to eighth and then past that. But, we're wearing the uniforms. It's definitely cliche that you see some movies. One great film was called Heaven Help Us, about guys in Brooklyn in the 50s with the Franciscan Brothers, with Kevin Dillon, Andrew McCarthy. I recommend that to folks. But a lot happening there. Now, Bert, how has the reaction been on your end from the Wonder Year so far?
Well, it's really been tremendous. I'm so pleased. I was a little nervous in the beginning when I got phone calls or emails or text messages from some people who said they were crying at the end of the book, and I said that's not the emotion that I was looking for, but they were really tears of joy and remembering.
It's a great one to evoke, Bert. I mean, that takes talent.
Right. Well, it's really great. And what's been interesting, Bill, is that even though, you know, our Mize Court story was we thought it was unique all over the place, and not just from Long Island, from people from many other parts of the country, the wide smiles and the laughter that it's brought them, remembering their own block that they grew up on and the games that they used to play and the days that they remember sitting with their families watching the lunar landing or, the Olympics or the games. Very pleased with the reaction we've gotten so far and really been a pleasure.
Quickly, Bert, where can people get the book?
The book's available on Amazon.com in both print and Kindle version, and also at BarnesandNoble.com. So,
all right. Well, I thank you for being with us, Bert. It has been a pleasure talking to you about the book. Again, the book is called The Wonder Year, Bert Flieger. Please look it up. Purchase it. You'll be entertained through and through. Thanks again, Bert.
Thank you, Bill.
Have a good evening. Bert Flieger, folks. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Rod Gasper and Bert Flieger, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour 2 on Sports Talk 1240. We'll see you next time. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.